Thank you, Lynn, and good morning, everyone, and welcome to our first Unitarian Zoom service for July the 5th. I'm David Vest, serving as worship associate today, along with our hardworking Zoom crew. That would include, of course, Rebecca and Lynn, and our guest homilist, Reverend Patricia Trudeau, and Wilburn Hayden, who will be doing a reading for us. Bill Glassman, our screen sharer, video sharer. David Richardson, who's doing the spotlighting and the breakout rooms and other stuff. Wally DuTemple, our offline tech support. And Jamie recording and doing our video editing as usual. And if you're having any technical problems, you can call Wally and Rebecca will have his contact information in the chat box. Wherever you may be located this morning, I'm sure you'd like to join me in acknowledging that our church is physically located on the traditional land of the Wasanich First Nations people. We always want to welcome new visitors at First Unitarian, and if you're joining us today or if you're a recent newcomer and haven't really introduced yourself, please use the chat box to let us know who you are and how you came to find us. And check our website for upcoming events, or you could contact our church office and ask to receive our e-weekly, and that email address will be in the chat room as well. I have some more announcements. First, about the kids programming. Regular kids and youth programs will resume in September. In the meantime, social justice story time is continuing through the summer. 8:15 a.m. Monday through Saturday, and all ages are welcome. Also this summer, our congregation is partnering with other congregations in the Pacific Northwest to offer a range of UU kids camps over the summer. Each week, we'll explore UU values, spiritual practices, and social justice through a different method, such as food, theater, dance, or Minecraft. And I'd also like to give you an update on our auction. Auction payments and donations are still trickling in, but I can tell you that so far, the auction has raised an amazing $25,990 for the church, which is over $4,000 more than last year. Thank you to everyone who contributed in any way, and a personal aside, thank you especially to those who made the pies. Now, an announcement about an upcoming survey. The board's COVID-19 task force will be conducting a survey to gather the thoughts and feelings of the congregation on restarting church services and other functions, and this survey will inform board decisions. The survey will be sent out approximately July the 10th. In order to help you with the questions on the survey, they'll be holding a Zoom forum to present the details of the options and then ask for questions and discussion. And this is scheduled for Wednesday, July the 8th, this coming Wednesday, from 7 to 8 p.m. And the information on that will be in the chat, as well as the link for that Zoom meeting if you'd like to discuss this survey about reopening. Well, we're in the summer now, and our ministers are on study leave and holiday. And in their absence, I am so pleased to welcome to our virtual pulpit Reverend Patricia Trudeau, who will now lead us in lighting our chalice.
Thank you. Thank you, David. The chalice lighting words are appropriately, Chalice Lighting for Challenging Times by Lisa Doge. Why a flaming chalice? The question comes. It's the cup of life, we answer. A cup of blessings overflowing. A cup of water to quench our spirit's thirst. A cup of wine for celebration and dedication. The flame of truth, the fire of purification. oil for anointing, healing, out of chaos, fear, and horror. This was the symbol crafted a generation ago. So may it be for us in these days of uncertainty, sorrow, and rage, and a light to warm our souls and guide us home. Thank you. There are so many hearts and hands that go into making these services, and I truly appreciate the tech support, the tech rehearsals and organization here. It's just wonderful. Thank you. That was beautifully presented. Our centering prayer, our meditation, is by Reverend Mel Hoover, a friend of Wilburn's, a Black minister in the United States, a friend of mine. We can dare to face ourselves in our entirety, to understand our pain, to feel the tears, to listen to our frustration and confusion, and to discover new capacities and capabilities that will empower and transform us. Empower and transform us. Mel Hoover. Wilburn.
In honor and praise to Black Rage by Tyler Coles. Deep in the shadow of night, down near the crossroads and cemetery gates, with bitter liquor and cigarette smoke waffling, I greet you. Clad in white, upon the floor before shrines, following the names of ancestors being uttered, I greet you. You are the sacred and righteous rage of my people, echoing throughout time from the lands of our elders, from depths of the oceans. I hear you now. You call out to us in swirling winds, in the clamoring of lightning, in the crashing of waves, in the flow of rivers, in the rustling of forests, in clouds that move across the heavens, in the drumbeat of the earth. You are present in the cries of Black Lives Matter, and no justice, no peace. You shimmer brightly in the flames of buildings crumbling to the ground as they are consumed in flame, in the calls for protest and direct action, in the stringing of pots, in the laughter of children, in the tears and prayers of guardians. You are Black Rage, holy and sacred, unbound and unapologetic. You swell in the hips and breasts, in the curves of cheekbones and nostrils, the beats of hearts and pulsating thoughts, in exhaustion, in frustration, in numbness, in mobilization, in life, and you name yourself as good. Holy and sacred, Black Rage, be ever present in our struggle for liberation, in our work to be, to love, to exist. Guide our movements in all their forms as we strive to be good ancestors, ensuring that the descendants might look upon our memory with favor. For you, for them, invite us to live without fear. Dear holy and sacred Black Rage, give life to this valley of dry bones. Move like fire upon our spirits, stirring within us and now forevermore. I forgot to say who I am. I'm Wilburn Hayden. He's a professor emeritus and senior scholar, School of Social Work, York University, and the husband of Reverend Patricia Trudeau.
Thank you. Before I begin, I want to say how wonderful it is to be with all of you. And I thought I wouldn't know anybody, but I see Reverend Jane Bramadot, one of my inspirations, on the call. And there was a wonderful person with us when Wilburn was speaking at the Black Lives Matter round table for CUC. She was in my discussion group. And if you would identify yourself on the chat, I would love to see you again. On Saturday, May 30th, just about a month ago, the week of the murder of George Floyd and after the ensuing riots, our son, Donovan, a 23-year-old, called us after participating in a demonstration where police had responded with tear gas and rubber bullets, a first for him. I asked how he was feeling. He said, "I'm hangry, Mom," and that he had felt nauseous from the tear gas. The incendiary incident that lit the spark was the public killing of George Floyd, the equivalent of a modern-day lynching. Protests persisted all over North America, including Canada. In places, police answered the protests against police violence by persisting in more police violence. The next day, I asked my husband, Wilburn, whom you've just met, how he was feeling. Wilburn responded, "I'm tired, tired." Wilburn grew up in segregated South and came to Canada in 1975 to do a PhD in social work. As an activist turned educator, he's been fighting the fight for over 50 years, and he gets tired of hearing how much better it is to be Black in Canada. Mostly, he remains quiet, but if he trusts the person, he will say that he feels safer in North Carolina, where he knows where he stands racially. He just gets tired of Canadians telling him how good it is here. On June 1st, our son called, that was a few days later, after the second protest, and asked, "Are you watching? Are you watching the news? Did you see what happened at the protest?" He asked with a sense of urgency. "Oh, please, please tell me that you are okay. That's what I wanted to hear." I had not the heart to tell him that I was watching Anne with an E, season 3, you know, the episode in which Anne and her young friends confront the town directors about freedom of speech. The two just don't seem to compare. He was outraged, upset that the police had opened fire on a peaceful protest, and he was disheartened. When the police opened fire, the protesters were sitting on the ground with their hands up, shouting, "Don't shoot, don't shoot." They were chased and set as they were walking away, and 22 were arrested. This is as they were fleeing. Tired, hungry, outraged, saddened, disheartened, these are all words that come down to the same thing. Black people, people of color, Indigenous, are exhausted from living in fear, exhausted from trying to explain it, exhausted from looking over their shoulders and often seeing no backup. In Canada and the USA, they are demanding that white people speak out and add their voices to the chant, "No justice, no peace, no racist police." It does not have to be perfect. We do not have to speak with great wisdom or articulation. Let's not worry about the grammar. They need to hear our imperfect voices speaking with them. Many Unitarians I know feel shy, uncertain, unqualified. That comes out in our discussions. "I might say the wrong thing," is a comment often heard. Speaking for myself, I often say too little or too much and at the wrong time. White people have the option to wait for a better time or just to say nothing. People of color cannot hold back. And if they do, they're afraid that their silence will be interpreted as assent. White silence can often be seen as a form of violence by those whose voices are not heard and whose words are devalued. A mother whose child is being beaten down does not choose her words carefully. She simply wails, "Get off of him!" and protects his body in any way she can. This week, on Monday, our son called to say that he was being interviewed by social media concerning a case action lawsuit that he and five others had filed against the police, the mayor, and the city of Pittsburgh for police actions and denial of the use of force. It was reported on TV, radio, and even made it to the Washington Post and the New York Times. Certainly, I felt proud of him, but in my mother's heart, I felt terrified, scared that he would be trolled and even harassed in retaliation for the suit and his articulation on public media about the misreporting of events. I asked him again how he felt. He said, "I am ready. I just wanted you to know." In our call this week, he asked me to remind white Canadians, whoever I would be speaking to this week, that we are all complicit in racism and that it does happen here in Canada. Many Canadians have been lulled by the pervasive myth of protection and acceptance of Black immigrants. Some Canadians are even loath to admit that there was slavery in Canada, despite evidence to the contrary. And some of that evidence and some of that narrative is on Wilburn Hayden's website. If you get a chance, there's a lot of research reported there. The book, Policing Black Lives, State Violence in Canada, From Slavery to the Present, is a book that has inspired me and that I read every day. Robin Maynard, the author, traces the still living legacy of slavery across multiple institutions, shedding light on the state's role in perpetuating contemporary Black poverty, unemployment, racial profiling, law enforcement, violence, incarceration, immigration, detention, deportation, exploitative migrant labor practices, disproportionate child removal, and low graduation rates. No part of Canada is innocent in the history of disrespecting Black lives and Black bodies. We didn't study it in school, many of us, but it's been happening. As you know, I don't have to tell you, there is trouble in the world. Many more trouble than the pandemic, although current resistance is exacerbated by COVID-19 shutdowns and losses. The intersectionality of poverty, pandemic, precarious employment, and policing have resulted in tension that is pulling people apart. And what has all this got to do with us as white Canadians? The death of Regis Porchinski Paquette occurred 2 days after the killing of George Floyd in Toronto, a few blocks from our home. Then there was news about the killing in New Brunswick of an Indigenous woman by police. There were incidents in Winnipeg, 3 Indigenous people murdered by the police within 10 days. 16-year-old Aisha Hudson, 17-year-old Jamie Addo, and Jason Collins, a 32-year-old father of 3 children. What is heartening is that protests have emerged all over Canada. That's the good news. Thousands of people gathered in Centennial Square in downtown Victoria Sunday evening, June 7th, for a vigil and peace rally for Black lives. Sadly, on the same weekend in which people were protesting racial justice, racists targeted Victoria Chinese Public School on Fiskard Street with racist messaging. But resistors pushed back. Residents pushed back. Good for you. Good for you all. The protests in Canada have been mostly peaceful media. The protests in Canada have mostly been peaceful. Media is very quick to report. different from those in the USA. It's different here, many say. We respond in a lawful manner. Different response, different laws and history, different stats. Different, it seems to me, has become the operative word for better. The protests in Canada, it all comes back to the insidious belief that Canada is better. We are more civil, more disciplined, more caring and courteous. Sure, our police can get a little rough, but their actions are not racially motivated. They are not as brutal. Many would say, and I've heard it so many times, they are just doing their jobs. Looking at the stats on incidents of police violence toward racialized people and the deaths at the hands of police, it becomes apparent that policing in Canada is the extension of the containment measures used since black slavery, used to ensure that black bodies are controlled and contained. Ask any black person in Canada about their experiences with police, and it will be a different story from the narrative of serve and protect. Non-white Canadians report that they experience racism here in perhaps more subtle forms, and that police are not the only perpetrators of racism. The police just have more authority and power to protect and to enact the ethos that maintains that black people are dangerous and the public white needs to be afraid. I wonder sometimes if we've got it turned around, if it's been inverted. It seems to me that black, indigenous, and people of color have more to fear than their white counterparts. For years, I've been faced with disbelief and revisionist views of Black Lives Matter from white people, including friends and family, who are quick to offer a reasonable explanation of what happened. Sure, Wilburn was denied entry to a parking lot at night until I intervened because he asked me to, but he did not have to make such a big fuss about it. Yes, some people cross the street when they see a black man like Wilburn coming toward them, but maybe they were just crossing anyway. Someone commented last week that Donovan is probably safe because his skin tone is light. The same person once said, "I don't like to think that things like that happen in Canada," when I shared a racist incident that had happened to our family. When a white woman clutches her purse a little tighter as a black man passes by, the black man knows what it means. When someone says, "I don't see color," black people hear, "I don't see you." Color blindness is a privilege and an erasure. A friend on Zoom, a tireless activist for social justice, shared this week that he feels impotent because he can no longer join the protests due to illness and age. I could relate. He does speak out just by calling us and dialoguing about race, by organizing and supporting those who are on the front lines of the protests. He recommended a book that I imagine many here have read or looked at, a book by Robin DiAngelo called White Fragility. When Donovan talks to us about his anger, it is not just about recent incidents or events, but rather a culmination of racial insults and harassment inflicted by Toronto's finest. It's about all the times he has been stopped in public by police and asked for ID, even in the company of white friends, carding. These friends are not asked where they are going or where they live. They're not asked to have a friendly conversation, and they are certainly not apprehended for jaywalking. A Black Unitarian minister, Reverend Fulgence, who lives in Saskatoon and came a few years ago from Burundi, related, it is about everyday incidents and trying to prepare your children for racism that they will ultimately face. He posted this message, I think it was on Facebook. "My dear friends and colleagues, it's been quite a few days for people of color and especially Black people. It has been generation after generation and centuries of abuse and mistreatment. The murder of George Floyd is horrible, and this is an understatement, but for Black people who live in countries where white supremacy reigns supreme, that murder is a trigger for what we have to go through on a daily basis in the form of arrogance, ignorance, belittlement, microaggressions, and ultimately death. Another book that I would recommend is The Skin We're In, written by Desmond Cole, a Black activist and journalist. For weeks now, I have pondered the questions posed by fellow white Canadians in the midst of this current turmoil, and added corollary, or what I like to call reverse questions. And I've been inspired by TV journalist Trevor Noah. He does fantastic monologues at the beginning of the show. Why now is a question asked. The reverse is, why not now? It's all coming together, not like pieces of a puzzle, but like great slabs of dark mass colliding and producing friction. This is no surprise. The forces of racism, injustice, policing, pandemic, and poverty are intrinsically linked and woven together. The pot that was simmering is boiling over. There is no point in trying to put the lid on the protests. No use in hollering and throwing up both our hands, in the words of Marvin Gaye. Even though protesters have held up their hands in the face of police retaliation, they've still been met with rubber bullets, flares, and gas. Another question, why such a strong reaction here in Canada? I ask, why not? As many of you know, Canada has a history of racism that has been largely ignored. We have a disgraceful record of police brutality toward unarmed people of color that is largely not recorded or quantified and often not reported. We as Canadians do not keep specific demographic data on police arrests or the disproportionate effects of COVID-19 on racialized people who form a large segment of the front line of workers in healthcare and the service industries. What we don't know cannot hurt us or shame us, or can it? Another question, what has this got to do with me? Why not you? Why not me and all of us? I hear people say, I'm a really good person. I have Black neighbors and I always speak to them. I work with Black people. I have friends who are Black. I treat everyone the same. I don't see color, and I am certainly not a racist. Don't call me that. The reality is that we inhabit a system that enculturates us from the time we can talk. Both whites and non-whites absorb centuries of messages about their place in society. There is a reason why almost all kids, Black and white, choose white dolls. We learn that non-whites are inferior even before we can speak. We learn that police are good and protect us. We learn that we are entitled to the best things in life and have to be careful not to let those others steal it, loot it, or borrow it. We deserve our comforts and we fear disruption. We live in fear. Finally, the question, what can we do? What are we called to do? Those are the words of Meg Roberts, Reverend Meg Roberts. What are we called to do? CUC acknowledges in a statement online that not everyone feels safe or is able to join the demonstrations, but we can do something. We can all do something. As we move from fear to engagement, these are steps we can take. Acknowledge how racism has shaped all of us. Racism is like an invisible gas that we all breathe. Whether one benefits from it or internalizes messages that harm us, racism shapes our thinking and actions, often unconsciously, and even if we don't want it to. Once we acknowledge that, then we can take the next steps. Too often, the job of speaking out against racism is left to people of color, which is unfair. To be effective, all people must be willing to do a good part of the heavy lifting. These are the following are the words of Alicia Cox Thompson, a Black activist, Canadian Black activist. Supporting Black people in meaningful ways is important, and there are ways to do so without burdening them or asking them to educate white people on racism or white privilege. Listen more and speak less. That can be a tough one because we are a people who speak up. If you are not part of a Black community, it is important to listen to Black voices first and foremost. Every group of people should have self-determination when it comes to defining a social movement and responses to injustice, writes Lisa M. Stuhlberg, an associate professor of sociology and education. So we listen first, and my son is always reminding me of that. Listen, just listen. And even when I feel like I'm not doing anything, if I listen to him, I am. Get educated, read. It's not the job of marginalized people to educate non-marginalized people on history or their experiences. The biggest mistake we can make, that one can make, is to ask Black people to perform the labor of teaching us about what they are experiencing and how we should behave. Again, the words of Alicia Cox Thompson. She says, "Don't ask me how to help you learn. Do your own research." The other mistake is performative allyship, performing for others. People who post the hashtags to boost their own image for likes and follows. Just listen and learn and never stop, she says. Reading about Black history and experience is vital, Stuhlberg writes, and white people should read widely and consume media art produced by Black people. Desmond Cole made a point in the news, a news article, that a lot of times we tend to read books, when we read about racism, we read books written by white people. And he asked the question, how many people have read an entire book on racism, read it and gotten to the end? So read a book written by a Black author. And there are many. Speak out against racism. It's important to speak out against racism in conversations in everyday life with people around us, including family, friends, and coworkers. If you are white, you have privilege that people of color do not have, Stuhlberg said, and have access to other white people in ways that people of color generally do not. I just had a difficult conversation with a family member, a conversation that I thought I could never have. And it went well. Donate to community organizations. If you can at this time, giving money to causes that support Black Lives Matter, Black communities is helpful. And this is one that comes straight from me. Say hello. Most days I speak to neighbors on the street. I ask them how they are. Most white people stare and look away. Rarely have I gotten that response from a Black person, with the exception of Black teenagers who kind of look confused. When Wilburn comes home, he'll say to me sometimes, and report happily that a white stranger spoke to him. He'll say, somebody said hello to me. And I feel pleased for him in some ways and really annoyed in others that he is so often invisible. Why wouldn't someone speak to him? In closing, I want to invite all of us as Unitarian Universalists, and in particular fellow white Unitarians who have most experienced the police as operating in our interests, to pause and breathe and open our hearts as we begin to deeply interrogate the system, deeply interrogate the system. I'm not speaking today as one who is woke. I speak as someone who is scared, worried, at times anxious, and at times overwhelmed. Some days I get so angry. I'm speaking as a wife and mother, and as a white Canadian with many privileges, who experiences racist thoughts and sentiments every single day. At those times, I need to ask myself the hard questions and begin again. Not questions like, what's wrong with them? Or how can I help? But questions like, what can I learn from this? What are my privileges? What can I do differently in my own life? What would I be willing to give up in order to help? I am speaking, too, as a Unitarian Universalist minister who still believes that despite missteps and setbacks by our denomination, we are making progress. Our faith is grounded in principles that call us to justice, equity, and respect in human relations for the dignity of all humans. I just want to hear those principles called out a little bit louder and a little clearer toward collective active engagement. A little louder. There is a deeper layer of understanding that our faith calls us to pursue. May we find those places within us to strengthen us in the days ahead. Today, I ask one more question, which will be posted. What alternatives and systems can we create to repair the harm done to Black folks in our lives, communities, and congregations? What alternatives and systems can we create to repair the harm done to Black folks? We can all do something. Thank you for listening. And now, as we extinguish the chalice, I have these words. These are words by Maureen Killoran. No matter how weak or how frightened we may feel, we each have gifts that can make a difference in the world. In this coming week, may each of us do at least one thing to support the broken, to welcome the stranger, to celebrate what is worthy, to do the work of justice and love. Be strong and be connected. Each day act so that you may be a little more whole.
Thank you, Reverend Patricia, for your words of wisdom and inspiration. And thanks also to Wilburn Hayden for joining us with that powerful reading. And thanks to everyone who listened. Thanks to all of you for worshiping with us. During this time, when we're meeting virtually and cannot pass around a basket or an offering plate, it's more important than ever that the congregation continues to receive your support. If you're able, please continue to give to the church and keep up with your 2020 pledge. You can give by mailing a check to the church or by clicking the donate button on our website. Rebecca is putting the link for donating online in the chat box and also the address for mail-in checks too.